This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Word feeling. Actually, he rightly is changing and shifting, and because you're trying to make these words. And again, there. Once you talk about unconscious, I think it's because of what I said, that the unconscious, the imaginative, and the numinous are way out here, just beyond your actual data. Everything. It's a kind of a business of focus, and the boundary is shifting all the time. The boundary can contract. When it becomes intolerable, there's very clear evidence that when it becomes intolerable to know a fact, you can cease to know it and the boundary contract, but the fact exists out here no longer as a fact, but then charged, this is where Jung, it does make things much clearer than Freud. Now, Freud wanted to say it was still a fact, but he didn't want to have this creative area that the consciousness is. The consciousness is an area of individual creation, but within a common material. Everything we create consciousness with is a commonly learned material of pictures and words, and those are not individual in any sense at all. They're the mass of human experience. The pictures begin first. The pictures must begin, or the spoken word, but we. And its traces must be dim indeed. But we do have early pictures on cave walls. And beginning with those pictures, coming forward, we have all the many languages, and that is what our individuality is built up on.
Now, but predating the pictures and predating our own individual lives, there's funny game walking around that we eventually inherit, and predating our own experience.
Yeah. We all give these forms.
So there is this moment, the chemical change that makes that start somehow.
I'm very satisfied with Robert's sense of all that I am aware of by whatever means of the organism that I am, I would feel all that I'm conscious of is one sense.
Mm-hmm. So that now, a vague impression that there's an unconscious is, oddly enough, a thing that's in the consciousness.
Yes.
I mean, certainly if we were to think of us en masse as human beings, and think of what's happened we are in a period of intense psychologizing, what are we doing? We're sitting here talking about consciousness. If we were in 1932, we'd be talking about economics, and consciousness was off the ball. But by the way, I'm not talking about we are talking about it. We are concerned with that, and that's where that's how you know your work, by the way, is because, again, look how direct it is. You're just uninterested when you go outside of your territory. You really don't have to wander around and wonder. The wandering around is usually not finding that territory. But when you find it, and then you can feel rather odd about it because it seems so intensely individual when you hit upon an interest. And you keep thinking, and maybe some of this mechanism of the poem, how do I make this so intensely self-involved thing, how do I make this tolerable or interesting or of concern to the people around me, because we are living in that. I mean, the picture, I remember reading blue books from a professor who evidently had the picture of Emily Dickinson, that she was a sort of a bad social case, and I actually read a blue book I wrote on the top just, you ought to be a social worker, but I was unsophisticated. It was a social worker. It would take a few more units. But the picture of Emily Dickinson was, you know, sick and that poor girl having to be content with eternity, and she wasn't very nice to. She wasn't even very sociable to people who came to call. She'd go upstairs and hide. Those poems didn't go upstairs anywhere and hide. I mean, a human being finds always a place and way in which to exist in a human community, and very knowingly. I mean, and when you do have a Let's say when you do have something that it would be extremely difficult to explain to the human community around you, where you really want it to happen, not in you, and then that also is your question about what do you want that poem to do that says, my head is cut off from my body. Well, why would you scribble on a piece of paper to look at it yourself? No, you want it to continue and to go out there until it becomes real, which means it's totally human.
Actually, the question of that poem was, since this was a new discovery of the last month for me, or a realization of the last month, going back and seeing that poem written 20 years ago, I realized I was writing myself a message to take account of, which I could use then at that time to think about, like a poem or a riddle or to unlock to work with. Also, I was sending my message off a message for the future, so that when I opened the book at that moment, there, on the podium, I would get that message reaffirmed throughout the continuity of the awareness, and so it would seem more real, or it would validify or reinforce or reassure me that, you know, I was not just sort of crazy,
oh, by the way, this picture of that message. That won't even work out. we can cure that remark simply by referring to at least one that comes to mind. I do not know where there is a devil in Taoism of any kind. There, not in the sense that you're making of this. Of this above below system.
And esoteric Buddhism has no devil.
Yeah, no God, as a matter of fact.
But then, if you want devils, what I hear are these funny screens we pull down in front of our various senses.
Well, the goblin again.
Yeah, goblin.
You know, but what I'm asking for is, you know, it's not referring to the theological devil. The theological devil has kind of function just like the deep God. And that is, it finds the area of danger. Now, in some systems, when they use the devil, it becomes no matter. And that's the devil. Well, quickly, this is not what you have in mind.
No, but I want to get back the point, and I'll have to reiterate again about this Taoism thing. In Taoism, there's no danger. It could just be written, no danger. And I'm not saying that... If there's a devil in the system, work with it. I mean, that's a picture. And I'm not... This is a great, potent picture. But you made the remark that there never is a human system in which there isn't a devil. There certainly is. There are ways in which there are whole great human pictures that really write the message, no danger. All you have to have is the disregard for personal death, pain, and all sorts of other things, or the personal regard in which they become experiences. Like my aunt who wants to die to find out what it's like. How are you going to get below that and tell her that she's afraid of death? The one thing I haven't done yet, it used to be, there's one thing I haven't done yet, I haven't gone to, and now she says, one thing I haven't done yet, I haven't died. I've got to die. And she isn't waiting for it, she's just thinking now, and that's probably the best of all because she gets to do it. I didn't chicken out at all.
You bring up the devil again?
Yeah.
Chicken devil. What if you want a devil, you can have
one.
Don't bring a devil on video. Right?
Yeah. Dry up? No, because, yes, you mean, like, oh my God.
Well, I mean, nothing is happening. Does it have to be continually bad or not? Or does it have to be?
No one ever had a picture of an unconscious that had to be fed. The picture usually is that you may be separated from your unconscious. That's part of Alan's picture of my head and my body, is one of those, something of me may be separated from other resources of the me. But the drying up of the unconscious. Oh, wait a minute. I know Sunar Blavatsky, just the same thing is here. Yes, Madame Blavatsky talks about drying up a vast ocean of a thing that certainly just sounds like the unconscious. So, there, yeah, people have had the picture of drying. See, almost any minute you start saying no, and then you suddenly remember, this is where it is valuable to read other people's work. You suddenly remember, no, some awful human being over there said that the unconscious does dry up and become a Gobi Desert. In the place of the Gobi Desert, she said, there were vast lakes of wisdom, which they became more and more like the unconscious. They were vast waters that were the holy waters of all that now is called vile, despicable, and so forth. And here is a legend of the mind mentalism. Mentalism dried up these and converted them into a desert of the same thing. So what had been life, water, great oceans, became death, sand, fire.
I think historically what's happening is actually the unconscious is rising and it's becoming more available to us now as a historical phenomenon out all over the world. But when I went out to build the bathroom, I saw that, unlike when I went to school, the walls here are covered with the most unabashed pictures, poems, messages going back and forth, like it's really mad. And finally, the key on the upper right-hand side. So it said, smile, please. The candid camera is watching.
But, well, these would be...
In other words, it's returning this to like what is the national consciousness. So in a sense, there is a university unconscious, which is being expressed there.
Well, I don't know if that's unconscious.
Here's the point. Like, in certain social situations, the pressure of mind may be such as that material, which somebody might have just scrawled in the bathroom, is actually dropped down to the level of the unconscious because it would be too embarrassing to either reveal or even think about knowing about in those moments of like a board conference room, say. Whereas at other moments in the day, that material might rise to consciousness on account of there's no pressure against it. And if he's in a situation where it's all around him, this is always okay. I'll put mine on now.
Oh,
really? So I was wondering. Are you down the door, boom?
There used to be a very famous mural, I understand, at the University of California. I never had the courage to go in the ladies' room to see it, but I thought I'd keep that as one of those imaginary intersects. As a matter of fact, at times it would get exceedingly lurid, and I would ask, is it in color? And it was never, no lady ever really told me concretely what it was of, so I was able to go on with all sorts of pictures. But I do have an objection. The area in which we have what we have is the difference between the attempt, as in Lady Chatterley, for where you have in the sexual passages of Lady Chatterley, or the attempt of Joyce and Molly Bloom's to have a what is to restore those words to a poetic level. I actually find the graffiti, except for the presence of magic, what they are doing is a magical intent, fantastic and magical intent. I don't think there's unconscious is at the level of the actual picture you see. That is, if there's, obviously, if you're drawing a picture of, I can reach for pieces of chalk. And a professor demonstrating on the blackboard history may have the whole class looking at the picture of a cunt and giggling even, but a man drawing on the blackboard, in the sense that it's unconscious, drawing on the blackboard one of these sexual images, then if it is unconscious, literally it means he is drawing something he doesn't know.
Yeah.
And so that in what they're doing, and Freud actually said, all right, if there is an area in which people are writing in John Walls and so forth, graffiti, and then there must be an area in sexuality that they don't know about, if it has this magic. Well, what is magic? I mean, I refer to magic all the time. Magic is the human sense that just below the consciousness, there is always imminent a discovery, like Alan's of looking and seeing suddenly, oh, it meant that my head was separated. There's always imminent a discovery that you aren't seeing. Now, it's not, in the beginning when I wanted to write it that far, that I was going to take it for granted that when I wrote more than I knew. There was, I was somewhat delighted in the perversity that there was a pretension in this. And I was pretentious, though because I like, actually, you know, compared today with the prohibitions of sexuality, the prohibitions of ego and other things are much bigger. I mean, just that he's a pretentious poet, and that is much more damning than saying he's a dirty poet. I mean, and we have come to a place where saying he's a sexual poet really sounds pretty good. But there is a pretense, there is a, what is make-believe there? That you almost make-believe you can do it when you're saying anything because you are making do, and you are making a belief for something that beneath that is faith. Because there is a faith that you write in the poem, the faith that the thing that you're telling you is right.
But there's another thing that I was realizing when I saw the message, which was that even though I thought at the time I did not know the point, all along at that time I really did know and was able to write it down. So that it was like the whole being there, who was there all along, who manifested himself by means of this poem. Or I was there and manifested myself by means of this poem. But I was there all along and knew it. I knew as much then as I know now. Did not know consciously, but my whole life of at age 20 knew it, as much as my life at age 38 knows it now. And somehow the poem kind of gets on that area. A poem seems to come from that area, express that area, and be of that area.
Well, then let's get back to this picture. So why is it, I do think in the poem, that there is both a human drive to become more, to bring things forward, to be conscious of them, but what is, how does this serve as a function to be more and more conscious? What does occur to me is that it's a challenge to the unconscious. Not a war, but everything that you bring up into consciousness really makes active that resource. See, how does it dry up? Not by having more in consciousness, by having less in consciousness. The whole picture of the closed rational mentality, which I've drawn in that essay that Warren had mimeographed and handed out, is to try to make an area that you can put into an absolute order and not be conscious of anything else, try to drive everything out. See, some of the question is rationality usually is, I will only be conscious of those things that I can put into ratios, into schemes, and close in the city wall. And outside will be pagans and the nice ones that feed you, and outside this will be the enemy. And they're back. What is that picture of nations? You see, it's breaking down. Actually, it's consciousness that is now seeing what Africa's like. And every one of those adventures I think of as not decreasing the thing you don't see, but increasing it. Because when you really see Africa, then the other Africa also is much bigger because it's released from this fact that Africa is also looking at the other Africa. When you see the person, well, there is the business that when you see what you're afraid of, when you, and that also is in Jung, although it's not a practice I practice, but he tells his patients that if they have a nightmare, they are to look for the thing they were afraid of and didn't see. Not to dissipate it. The business is not that when they look for it and see it, it'll disappear. But when they're to transfer it from this, because they're afraid of it, transfer it from this numinous unreal into the real. And he has the other law talk about the devil, that if you do not talk about the devil, if you do not concern yourself with him, if you do not want to find out who he is, then he will become evil. Evil is a power over you. Evil originally meant over, the thing above me, the thing that is a compulsion. So a habit always is an evil. A boss always is an evil. Although only you can make this thing an evil and acknowledge its hold over you. So that the devil becomes an evil when it's a hold over you, and it becomes a hold over you when you actually pay charge with the business of not knowing sin. Yeah.
I meant that the occasion is, or that the reference, the referential part, e.g. the difference between the mining disaster and the Hungarian revolt, is the vocabulary which the consciousness is using, or the reference of that consciousness. I meant that the location of the conscious is always in the person. In other words, it's always you or your father or your brother that is conscious. Its reference, as you're quite right to say, and Alan's sense in another way is to say the world is not, quote, smaller in a size sense, but smaller in the sense of the distances between things is now more easily encompassed. In other words, we can move, as he can, from Calcutta to here, or from Japan to here in 9 hours. The community, in that sense, has drawn into a wider ranging physically, but a closer...
And back of this is the will to move from Calcutta to here in 9 hours. And now, absolutely right, just beyond us, is the will to move, make that move in an hour and a half. 15 minutes to get started, and the rest to go, and 15 minutes to...
Trying to make a distinction that the conscious had its area of recognition or its awareness, physically a wider term of occasion, but that it stayed primary in each person. It was not, in other words, it was not extensive. By extensive, I mean we are not thinking as a world mind. We are always thinking as a person. We're not conscious as worlds. We are conscious as a one-to-one person. You're conscious in relation to that Hungarian revolution, those children, as you to them. You see, you're A to B, not
us
whole,
to them.
Yeah, not us.
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This much. Yeah.
No. It seems to me when something else extends in distance and in time and in a range, it seems to me implicitly you're going to India with that kind of saying something else exists over there which can't
quite true.
Extend me.
No.
Yeah, but also, as I think I always said in relation to going to India, it was to move the center so it was at India. Now, the peripheral thing is when you aren't there and it's way over there. I mean, Alan going to India then is Alan in India, so it's no longer it's no longer the way out there news. It's the insistence of seeing, touching, feeling, and
Thoreau says, "I have traveled much in Concord," which was an answer to this attack, I guess, upon him that he had no real experience of the world. In other words, what I meant by the vocabulary of the conscious was this, just what you say. In other words, its sense of occasion or its recognition of occasion is much more ranging in a physical and social, term. I don't quite know how to put it accurately, but that its function or its location is, to my mind, stays as it always has been in individual instances. We can now feel, let's say, by means of consciousness, socially, a wider grid or a wider context for the individual terms of our life, but the consciousness is still mine. You see,
I think your engagement with the television set goes just as far as you are engaged in reinterpreting those pictures, engaged in translating them into some. And usually I call my sessions of television brainwashing, because I don't engage in this. I mean, I look at silly things that you wouldn't want to reinterpret and brainwash. But the same thing with the newspaper. Both the dimensions of the newspaper and the television have been made into instruments that we wouldn't, all of us rightly mistrust in an area, and have to engage quite a bit in order to sense of what it was that did happen and the nature of it. I'm thinking about your immediacy to a thing. Now let's get back to your engagement in reading. In a newspaper, you're reading, and you will only get so much by that engagement of finding out what happened, and it's almost at the level of what we call facts that you prune away everything and emerge with. Or the other thing is the thing that we're in the Burroughs experiments, where you cut the newspaper up and you learn an entirely different thing. You learn what the newspaper says. You change things. You throw away what the newspaper is saying to try to get to facts, but then in these experiments of the newspaper, just by cutting them up, putting them in a new collage, you see, my God, over and over and over again, it's saying kill, smash, boom, bang. As I said, a real agency's gone in there to shape it, and if you can discard then the facts that ordinarily you'd be discarding the saying, and discarding the facts by cutting them up and putting them so that they've been decomposing the whole thing, you find out what that saying is. The same way an analyst finds out what the saying is, not by the story you think you're telling, by hearing that certain words are repeated over and over and over again, and that certain patterns go on and on and on and on. And are, but, all right, well then, poetry. I'm not talking about the trap.
That's the real trap. If you cut yourself, that's what comes about. That you go in there.
It's not a trap in reading a newspaper. You find out what's being said, and I think it's not a trap in a poem.
If there is a self to begin with, you can't.
You aren't going to cut up the self.
In other words, if you're only make believe. In other words, if you're only an intention, then that's of no interest. I mean, that's.
Yeah, but I don't. For instance, I was not saying you got the newspaper when you cut it up. You discovered something entirely new. What it's saying.
I think you cut up a poem and get it new.
No, but it seems to me that the reason I'm arguing is not that you can ask to. The problem is
cut that out.
Put that in the corner. It seems to me that the big problem is getting the conscious and the unconscious together.
Yes.
That when Brian goes in and he's saying, I had a dream of a beautiful ship, and he's sailing 3 meters, and the analyst says, "There you were, Buster, you were wanting that."
But he said it in that tone of voice.
Cut him up.
I know. Yeah, a boat.
I
I mean, that's the truth.
You say that's the truth.
Look,
now, there are such different interpretations that can be given that come from the primal root.
But listen, there's something about this that's not pertinent. When you were cutting it up in class, that is for teaching, for critique. But you aren't writing a poem. You can cut up a poem when you're writing a poem, and it's an entirely different matter. I mean, and what I was speaking of in the newspaper is that actually we got a poetic vista in these newspapers being cut up. It proved not to be like it looked right at first, some crazy kind of game, just as when you're a child switching from one radio station to another back and forth, told you something amazing about, ordinarily you were listening fascinated like this to the radio program, but then when boredom came, and this always happens to me on TV, because it got so many channels, you switch back and forth and an entirely different drama appears. And actually, because it's one continuum, modern poetry, the picture often given in a literature course is that every poet has a reaction to previous periods of poetry, like they decide, like Swift, really, it looks like he didn't like Shakespeare. I mean, like he didn't like Tudor drama. It was in bad taste. But these judgments that look like judgments, we can show in an entirely different way. It's like cutting up the newspaper to find out what is happening. Instead of looking at that as a continuum or a critique, you find it uncovering by negations, by cutting up, by fracturing, and especially in our century it was cubism, and then all the efforts of Dada and surrealism toward magic to recompose the things that were being seen only as if you were looking along one line, and if you could come over here and see it. But then this, actually the business of just taking a pair of scissors is not this way, it's every single way, and then flat down like this, and what happens? What do you see happening? And this is not modern. We throw away the modern thing. They were doing that in the beginning, casting bones so that their habits, evil habits, the thing that was over you would suddenly be not disappear, but be seen. So it was not one thing at all, but everywhere, and was usable again. And you could move, and so of course it's always your own work you got to do this to, in a sense. My sense of this talk about the stop you come to is they really wanted what the other stuff, and they compared the stop directly to nothing will happen in this century. Yes. But we know what the alternative is to nothing will happen in this century. When we get through with that period, everything will blow up and be little tiny atoms again, and a new universe might be. Because that's a big image in our time, and the strong image. It even interests me that the mushroom, that's a drug, the first place we heard of the mushroom was not a drug, it was that thing that's drawn on. Now, like they say what you've drawn. But the mushroom. Then it becomes inscrutable. Why in the same century of all the drugs that have been used to have some kind of shaman-like sending out experience, and that is really to get some other perspective on the things that we think we've got one way of having a focus, of all those drugs, the one that was most attractive was the mushroom. Certainly there must be another part of it, and that is that the mushroom was a naturally growing plant that was taken... it was one mushroom among many mushrooms and the magic of the mushroom has always been there in mushrooms. Yeah.
Most of it is murky.
It's
mushroom.
Oh.
Mushroom.
Mushroom.
We both blow things up totally, and then Fred Hoyle comes along and says,
it's always coming into creation. Well, the other thing is there is only one place that a new idea comes in at all, and that is beyond the consciousness. Because there are all the pictures of this business of why all the engagements they've had with the pictures of engaging with the unconscious, or pacts with the devil, the one over there beyond the territory, or being a spy and going to the enemy and finding out what's happening. Oh, it's really weird that in the war you go to the enemy to find out what's happening, because what's home isn't happening. All of these pictures, but then they go on for a whole human engagement, really are, it does seem to me, is a continuous life engagement to have that new thing happen magically and not pass. The things do happen, and that's your primal experience is, when things happen to me, I change and grow and become different, and life becomes very, very vivid. So then the human being has always had an engagement to be able to make instances of life being vivid on in his own rights. I mean, finally, yet, well, just picture for a second what an ennui the solution would be. I can go over and switch the button and life will be vivid, and I can switch it back and life will be like it was. And then we play, actually, of course, we suddenly realize the predicament. I mean, we would not switch the button on and not switch it off, and then we'd say, what? It'd all go back, we've got the button on and off, vivid and not vivid. But that is not the way it comes to us, decently. And yet we're always trying to find one of those little ways.
This is again.
Somebody laying their consciousness on you, their mental consciousness on you, substituting that for yours.
That's what I'm afraid of, that they're telling me what I'm doing.
There's only black magicians trying to get their energy.
I think, John, that's what happens when the consciousness is posited as extra person or extra personal. That it is responsible.
Extraterritorial
is a very good way to put it.
This being territorial.
And again, thinking of the Hungarian Revolt, the impact of that, because it is, first of all, it's an event which one can never reach in time, and you're left with the agony of witnessing something that is affecting you, has to affect you. Your consciousness is your person, or is involved, obviously, with your person, and you are prohibited by context from ever arriving in time, which is an almost archetypal pattern of one of the problems of existence, one of the contexts of existence.
War?
Well, let's save it for much.
Yeah.
By changing the syntax.
Yeah.
Actually, literally, I don't know if people here are familiar with that material and with that technique. It would take a little time to...
Describe it, though. I think it's worth it.
Burroughs was, to begin with, he was a junkie. And so in withdrawing from junk, there was apparently a complete change of perspective and a whole new inrush of feeling and a whole new habit system and a whole new thinking process. Then he began applying it to other obsessions, other habits, including sex, including personal relationships, and then he began applying it to his writing. He had come to a point at the end of Naked Lunch where he was sort of what I was calling bankrupt and tied up. And then somebody, a painter friend of his, said, why don't you apply collage technique through writing. That is to say, simply take your writing and start cutting it up and recombine it to see what kind of new, this is a literary device, just to see what kind of new images will arise out of that. In other words, like taking your consciousness or your verbal consciousness outside of you, right on the paper, on the table, and then instead of like revising in your head or making combinations of words in your head, why don't you combine words physically on the page, on the table? That led, when he started cutting up his writing, he realized how much of the phrasing, how much of the syntax, how much of the turns of phrase, were just old habitual relationships. were habits. And I had very little to do with direct new feeling, and he began finding new combinations which like feed off or catalyze original secret feelings that he had all along anyway. So then he began applying this to all of his writing and began also then looking in the newspapers, like here he's reading Time magazine, and Time magazine is laying down a story on Laos or on Beatnik, with its terminology, its vocabulary, and its set attitudes, which are built also into Burroughs and into all of us, because we've all been subliminally brainwashed for years and years. If you take a Time article and begin cutting it up and then mix it with a new Masters article or with Pravda or with more Time from the medical page, you suddenly, the phraseology springs up nakedly, and you suddenly see how these people who are writing have their favorite phrases and their favorite perspectives, which they are laying down on you, like when they begin a article saying, short, fat, hairy, Robert Bridges today. Well, you know they've got an emotional attitude towards Robert Bridges. and which they're not saying, they're presenting as objective fact. And somebody reading it says, well, this man is short, he is fat, he is hairy, so you must be right in your estimation of Robert Bridges. So you cut that up and you find short, fat, hairy American foreign policy.
Yes, that's what happened. It's gorgeous.
And then you realize, you know, finally what it does is it neutralizes all the affective prejudice, a habit, black magic, sending that's built in. So what Burroughs, in a sense, did was to neutralize his prejudices that way about his own character and personality and about things outside of it. So his idea was to cut out, his idea also was that many of our affects, were, to the extent that consciousness has come up into the head and is a purely verbal, conceptual thing now, not any longer connected with the body, the guideline along which our consciousness runs, or the track along which our consciousness runs, on the fixed, habitual line, are verbal, our words, just as Pavlov showed. If you ring a bell, the dog mouth will flavor. If you say communism or short, fat, hairy to somebody, they have a, I don't want to be short, fat, hairy. So, in other words, he was attempting to cut the synaptic hang-up, that is, to cut through the verbal track, to cut through verbal thinking, even, to cut through conceptual thinking and return thinking to another level, or at least cut out a habitual verbal pattern for himself. So then, then when the Cuban crisis came, for instance, I was in India and I adapted his method just to cut my way out of all the anxiety and all the counter-paranoia that was going on. I took Kennedy's statement and I took Khrushchev's statement and I put them together and cut them up with a razor and then mixed them up like confetti, and then I retyped the whole thing out, and I had a real clear picture of what the Cuban situation was, which none of those guys was able to say. Mainly, I simply cut myself out of the whole anxiety, and I cut myself out in the sense of it gave me a objectivity and a lack of anxiety and a realization of how much these guys are coming on with their own obsessions, which is equivalent to apparently what's happened now, where they decided they were coming on with their obsessions and they'd better make up. Because I wasn't cutting into the irrational. I wasn't making things irrational. I mean, if they think they were rational then, well, that's their problem with rationality.
Well, what's somebody in the back here?
Here's a very quick instance. Excuse me. This it's on the magic box.
Sending that order on the back of a matchbox. Matchbox magician.
Robert comes up like this and just read this one.
What assurance have you got that you're dealing with consciousness to the mere alphabet? I mean, if you take a headline, Stephen Laycock loved his country, and used the citizens the right way, you get more beautiful sexual images.
Well, what is meaning?
Well, it seems to me that you've turned
it. Here, what you've done, you suddenly brought out the word love and said, what does the word love mean in that headline?
Yes.
You know, what relation does that have to actual living processes and to what you know about life and to what Stephen Leacock probably knew about life and even the guy who wrote that?
Like, what if they said he fell in love with his country? Or
oh, well. I'm afraid we'll have to stop because we're pretty late.
Yeah.
So, thank you.